From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The animated movie Chicken Run has just been released on video and DVD. It's a satire of The Great Escape with chickens. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with creators Nick Park and Peter Lord. Park also created the animated characters Wallace and Gromit. The Friars Club is a club for people in show business that's most famous for its testimonial roasts. We'll hear from comic Freddie Roman, dean of the New York Friars, and comic Jeffrey Ross, who's known for his hilarious insults at roasts. They're both featured in a documentary about the Friars that's just been released on video. Also, David Bianculli reviews the new TV series Queer as Folk, and Henry Sheehan reviews the new Taiwanese movie Yi Yi. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. After peppering both sides with scores of questions, the U.S. Supreme Court is now considering whether to uphold or overturn a Florida Supreme Court's decision in the presidential election. NPR's Barbara Bradley has more.
Ted Olson, the attorney for George W. Bush, was first up at bat. Several justices wanted to know what the federal question was, the issue that would prompt the high court to put itself in the middle of a state controversy. Olson said the Florida Supreme Court had violated a federal statute and the Constitution when it extended the deadline for votes. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg was perhaps the toughest on Olson. In case after case, she said, the Supreme Court has shown the highest respect for state Supreme Courts, leaving Olson to say that this was an exception to the rule. But the justices also took exception to the arguments of Al Gore's lawyer, Lawrence Tribe. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor told him that the law was clear, a deadline is a deadline, suggesting that when the Florida Supreme Court moved it, that thwarted the will of the legislature. Barbara Bradley, NPR News, Washington.
The Florida Supreme Court issued two rulings today that worked against Vice President Gore's effort to keep himself in the Florida race. The justices rejected Gore's request for an immediate hand recount of thousands of disputed ballots from Palm Beach and Miami-Dade counties. Those votes must now await a decision from Judge N. Sanders Sauls, who will hold a hearing on whether to count the ballots tomorrow. The state Supreme Court also refused a request from Palm Beach County voters who wanted a new election in their county, saying that the design of so-called butterfly ballots caused them to vote for Reform Party candidate Patrick Buchanan rather than Al Gore. The justices said the design of the ballot didn't clearly operate to prevent a free, fair, and open choice. Democrat Maria Cantwell has held on to her narrow victory over Republican Slade Gorton in the Washington State Senate race. Cantwell's victory means that the Senate could be split 50-50 when it convenes next month, NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Cantwell was initially seen as facing a tough task taking on Gorton, who has survived a series of difficult races thanks to his strong support in the more rural eastern parts of the state. But Cantwell, a high-tech millionaire, built up a huge well of support in King County and the western part of the state. Washington's sophisticated but slow recount ended up giving Cantwell a margin of more than 2,200 votes out of nearly 2.5 million cast. For Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott, the Gorton loss means he'll lose a personal friend and confidant. It also means that if George W. Bush becomes president and Senator Joe Lieberman returns to Capitol Hill, he'll be coming back to the first-ever 50-50 Senate. Lawmakers meet next week to elect leaders and take up unfinished business from the 106th Congress. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 41 points to close at 10,373 in active trading. This is NPR News from Washington. President Clinton used the occasion of World AIDS Day to call for more funding and research to fight what he said was an international security crisis. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
President Clinton noted that deaths from AIDS have fallen in the United States to their lowest level since 1987. But he said efforts to combat the disease still have far to go. He said the rapid spread of AIDS in struggling areas such as Eastern Europe pose a threat to global security. He said fighting the disease requires international cooperation.
It will depend upon, in equal measure, our will and our wallets. And it will depend upon, in some places still, sadly, going beyond denial.
The president said families around the world should talk about the facts of life before the disease spreads further. Speaking at Howard University in Washington, he called on Congress to fund his request for more money to prevent and treat AIDS. Pam Fessler, NPR News, The White House.
Vicente Fox took the oath of office today as Mexico's president, the first in 71 years who was not a member of the former ruling PRI party. Fox began his inaugural day with a visit to a basilica to pray to Mexico's patron saint, the Virgin of Guadalupe. Previous Mexican presidents have avoided public religious observations because of the country's historical efforts to shake off the domination of the Roman Catholic Church. He then stopped to help serve a breakfast to homeless children in Mexico City. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright attended the inauguration ceremony along with the leaders of 15 Latin American nations. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 47 points today to close at 2,645. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, seeking to enrich community life through support of education, the arts, and culture.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The animated movie Chicken Run has just been released on video and DVD. It's a satire of prisoner of war movies like The Great Escape and Stalag 17, but the prisoners are chickens, and the prison camp is a barbed wire British egg farm. We're going to hear from the two animators who co-created and co-directed the film. Nick Park is a three-time Academy Award winner who's best known for his short animated film starring the characters of Wallace and Gromit. Peter Lord is the co-founder and chairman of the Aardman Studio in England, which specializes in clay animation. Park has worked with Lord at Aardman since 1985. When Chicken Run begins, the chickens are feeling defeated because their attempts at escape have all been foiled. But the heroine of the movie, a hen named Ginger, refuses to give up. She puts her faith in a free-spirited American rooster named Rocky, who has accidentally wound up at the farm. Escaping becomes a necessity when the mean-spirited woman who owns the egg farm decides it would be more lucrative if, instead of selling eggs, she made chicken pot pies. So she gets a diabolical-looking pie machine and explains her plan to her nasty but dim-witted husband.
Ooh, that's champion, that is. What is it?
It's a pie machine, you idiot. Chickens go in, pies come out.
Ooh, what kind of pies?
Apple. My favorite. Chicken pies, you great lummox. Imagine it. In less than a fortnight, every grocer's in the county will be stocked with box upon box of Mrs. Tweedy's homemade chicken pies.
Just Mrs.?
Woman's touch makes the public feel more comfortable.
Oh, right. How does it work?
Get me a chicken and I'll show you.
Last June, when Chicken Run was released theatrically, I asked Nick Park and Peter Lord if they did any research on chicken farms.
We did. We were going to spend, you know, 3 months living with chickens to, you know, to really do it right. But
this is the method approach to understanding chickens.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. And we actually ended up spending a day on a chicken farm. And we took a video camera with us and really got down on our knees with the chickens just to see what life is like from a chicken's point of view.
What did you notice that surprised you when you got down to a chicken eye level?
Gosh, I mean...
Well, they twitched a lot. You know, the thing about chickens, which we hadn't reckoned on, is that their heads twitch fiercely and convulsively the whole time. You know, and because their eyes are on the other side of their head, they're constantly moving their head around to see things. And we very rapidly reckoned this would make for a terrible movie because... You couldn't have a tender love scene because the two protagonists would instead of looking into each other's eyes, would be twitching their heads the whole time, you know, to look out first one eye then the other.
Yeah, in fact, we threw out, you know, what everybody knows as a chicken design quite early on in the film. So we had the knees bending the right way, and you know, we gave them hands instead of wings, and you know, generally improved, you know, what we know as a chicken.
Yeah.
Well, tell us what you did model the chickens on. The bodies, the heads, the eyes, mouth.
Well, you know, our chickens are such a daft group of characters that we wanted a lot of comedy out of them. And, you know, like the Wallace and Gromit films, we gave them big, wide mouths with lots of teeth and eyes that are touching in the middle. And it gives them a very funny kind of, you know, goofy and often deadpan look, which we play off a lot in the movie. And their bodies, we wanted to get a lot of mileage out of them being this group of very unathletic, unheroic group that have never really done anything or questioned anything in their lives, and pulling off this enormous stunt.
Let's talk about facial expressions, because I think that's the most communicative part of a body and probably a very difficult thing to put across in the kind of animation that you do, but you both do it so well. Maybe you could describe a little bit how you would express an emotion in clay animation, like confusion. You know, take one of the chickens that had to be confused at some point.
If you were to see the whole head of Rocky, it's only 2 inches high, and the space above his eyeball, and that space is, I don't know what, you know, a couple of millimetres. And it's with that tiny space that we play, and you can obviously make the brow frown by bringing it down in the middle. You can make a quizzical look by raising one side and lowering the other. And you can then make the eyes suddenly, sort of, as it were, pop out of the head, suddenly get very wide. So you're playing with this brow, which acts like eyebrows, the eyeballs and the eyelids, and you can use lids to blink in different ways and indicate, you know, I don't know, complacency and make the eyes smile. But you're talking about a tiny little canvas. And really, if you do as we've often done, you watch actors, watch a live-action movie and turn down the sound and see how the face acts, and it's frighteningly minimalist, you know, but it's those little signals that real people can give off very easily because they're real. We're trying to give those same signals in our puppets.
So you do this a lot. You watch movies with the sound off and just study the face.
Well, for this film, to try and get these expressions we've talked about, in practice, we talked to the animators at huge length about what we wanted, and about the motivation for this scene. And often, especially at the start of the shoot, Nick or I would end up rehearsing a gesture 30 times, just over and over again, to try and sort of somehow communicate it to the animator. And after a while, we thought, this is a mug's game. This is really slow. So we started to record ourselves on video. So that would be us with the sound down. We'd look at our own faces, mute, and see... You know, yes, how you talk about bewilderment. How does bewilderment show on the face? What are the brows doing? How wide are the eyes? How are the eyeballs shifting around? Because that's another great indicator. It's where the focus of the eyes is really crucial. Are they focused right on the person you're talking to? Are they drifting around the room looking at other details? You know, all this kind of thing.
You know, one of the things I really like about your animations is that let me just explain. You're working on this teeny tiny little set. You've got the clay figures that you're moving around in these small increments. And in the set with them, you have a mix of like little miniature objects you've designed, like little miniature like chairs and houses and beds and things like that. But there's also a few real things. Like, for instance, there's a scene where a chicken is trying to tunnel out of the chicken farm with a spoon. And I suspect that the spoon is real, because it certainly looks real. And so you have this mix of something that is absolutely real and something that's absolutely fantasy inhabiting the same reality at the same time. And it makes for very interesting viewing.
Yeah, that's what we always find interesting about it, really.
That juxtaposition of the real and the imaginary?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah,
in the same reality.
Yeah, because that's right. I mean, we are what the world we've created is a strange sort of twilight world between kind of real live action movie making, because you've got a 3D set but in miniature, you can light it, do camera work just as in any live action picture. At the same time, the characters, because they're made of clay, they can change shape and they can be very cartoony and. You know, so we're always just traveling this very thin line between how real, how gritty, and how smooth and how soft is this world?
Because there's a huge difference as well, really fundamentally, between that room you've described The bunk is made of wood, and you can see the texture of the wood. The bed has got straw in it, and you can see the texture of the straw. There's a piece of rusty old iron, you can see the rust. But then the chickens, our heroes, are these very, frankly, very cartoony constructs that look like clay. And intellectually, you'd never think that would work, I don't think. I think intellectually you'd say, that's crazy, that won't match, you know. But somehow it works, you know, supremely well, and you really believe the plasticine chickens in the real world. And that, again, that's just experience has proved that.
As we were describing, you work in these miniature sets for your animations. What does it do to your sense of size and proportion to spend your time in this teeny tiny miniature world?
Well, our sense of proportion went right out the window a long time ago. Otherwise, we'd be in some sensible occupation, I'm sure. I don't know. It's a very strange thing. For example, our chickens are 10 inches high, our model chickens, which is getting on for perhaps slightly more than half the size of a real chicken. So, relatively speaking, these are quite a big scale, because we're working to a half-scale thing. Imagine a chicken 10 inches high. Imagine a human comes into shot. The human ought to be, by that reckoning, about 3.5 feet high. And it's virtually impossible, and certainly agonizingly horrible, to work with an animated puppet 3.5 feet high, because animation ought to be hands-on and light and instinctive. And if the puppet's that high, you end up struggling with this massive engineering beast. It's really hard to bend. So we didn't do that. We made humans that were only 12 or 14 inches high, and miniature chickens, extra small chickens to go with the humans. So we ended up on two scales, which was one of the many things we stupidly didn't see coming when we stupidly decided to make a film about chickens, which we regard as our first mistake.
My guests are Nick Park and Peter Lord, co-directors of the animated film Chicken Run. It's just been released on video and DVD. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Peter Lord and Nick Park. They're co-directors of the new animated film Chicken Run, which is a comedy about chickens trapped in an egg farm surrounded by barbed wire, and it's played as if it were a World War II prisoner of war movie. And Nick Park also made the Wallace and Gromit animated short films, which have won several Academy Awards. Now, I have a confession to make. After seeing your movie and empathizing with these poor chickens, I ate a chicken dinner. Did I do the wrong thing?
Boy, what kind of movie is this? I'm sorry, it had no effect at all.
did you find yourself shying away from eating chicken while you were making this?
No, actually, no. Rather the opposite. Our appetites were increased very healthily.
We were vegetarians before. But...
Yeah. No, it is odd. No, I mean, Nick and I don't, personally, don't. We were on a plane yesterday. We both ordered the chicken. You know, we don't feel it at all, I have to say. But I thought maybe we were desensitized, whereas you, as a fresh viewer, might have the decency to hold off for a day at least.
I guess not. I guess the movie just wasn't powerful enough. Or I'm just too insensitive. Well, Nick Park, I have a question for you. Now, the new movie, Chicken Run. Chicken Run has a chicken pot pie machine, this insidious machine that the two mean-spirited humans have to bake these chickens into pot pies. And it's a bizarre contraption designed to take a whole chicken and mix it in with the chopped up peas and carrots and dough and spit them out the other end as a pot pie. And our hero and heroine have to escape their pot pie fate and get out of one of these machines. Now, Nick Park, most of your animations have bizarre contraptions of one sort or another in them. In fact, before I ask you the actual question, why don't you describe a couple of contraptions from your Wallace and Gromit movies?
Right. You mean a close shave?
Sure.
There's the wrong trousers, which are ex-NASA, in fact, that are actually bought from an ex-NASA store in Wallace's neighborhood. And, Wallace uses them to... They're covered in rivets. They're very round and robust and have a sort of 1940s feel. And I guess same too with the Knit-O-Matic machine in A Close Shave. That's all covered in copper sheeting and rivets and that kind of thing, and lots of arms and lots of Jules Verne, you know, H.G. Wells, and Victorian technology, I like to describe it as.
Yeah, and like the Knit-O-Matic, you put a whole sheep in one end of the machine, and out comes yarn, and by the end of the machine, I think a little sweater is coming out. These bizarre contraptions. Now, your father was an inventor. Did he make contraptions?
Well, he wasn't. I don't think I would describe him as an inventor, but he did make a lot of things. He spent his time in the shed making things.
What kinds of things?
Well, a lot of household things, you know, just shelves, that kind of thing.
Did he make a caravan?
Oh, that's right, yes. That's what made, after making the first Wallace and Gromit film, A Grand Day Out, I realised one day, he's so much like Wallace, because I recalled this childhood experience where my father built a trailer, you know, from scratch. It was like just a room on wheels, like a living room on wheels, and with beds inside, and made everything, and wallpapered it with furniture, and it had furniture and chairs and all that kind of thing. And the whole family, seven of us, went on holiday in this caravan.
Were you taken to any unusual factories when you were a kid?
Oh yeah, boy, I had this terrible experience of going to a chicken slaughterhouse. When I was a kid. I was actually a student at the time. I was doing a summer job, and I was working at a chicken packing factory, folding up plucked chickens and putting them onto trays and feeding them into this great big machine that wrapped them for the supermarket. And actually, one day I was sent down to the slaughterhouse because they were short of labour there, and saw some pretty horrific things there. And some of those ideas from both those experiences have actually come through and been used in Chicken Run.
Your characters of Wallace and Gromit, which are so popular now, tell us if you kind of patterned them on anyone you knew, either in real life or in the movies. And I should say Wallace is a British man who's very stuffy and proper sounding, but in reality he's really not very bright. Gromit is his dog, and the dog is the smart one who reads books like The Republic by Pluto. So who's behind these characters?
Boy, I don't think I ever really consciously based them on anybody particularly. Wallace, perhaps, you know, when I think about it, you know, for reasons that I've given, he is very close to my dad, who, he was like an inventor and made things. But I think it's his attitude, actually, the way he'll just get ideas and go about doing them without thinking. And he'll be, my dad isn't insensitive, but Wallace is very insensitive another influence, actually, he's very much like an old music hall character that's very much known in Britain, in the north, comes from the north of England, who plays a banjo, ukulele, and called George Formby. But again, it wasn't very conscious, you know, to base him. He isn't based on him, but I think these influences have found themselves in Wallace.
Did you have pets as a kid? Did you have a dog?
I never ever had a dog. Funny you should say that, though. We had a pet chicken.
Did you really?
It was our family dog.
Why did you have a pet chicken?
It was my sister's, actually. It was called Penny, this great big Rhode Island Red. And we just had it for the eggs, really. But it used to come in the porch, and we used to throw sticks for it and things like that. Never went and fetched them, but it was very much a pet, and we saw, my sister and I saw such character in that chicken, and we used to write short stories about this chicken, and one or two ideas have actually found themselves in Chicken Run, like Rocky being known as the Lone Free Ranger. That was a joke we had as a kid.
Oh, really? That's funny.
Yeah, but we never had a dog.
Huh. Did you always want to make cartoons when you were young? Did you see those old cartoons and thought, I want to do that too?
Yeah, yeah. I just watched everything and took it all in. I had no idea how they were made, and so they always had an intrigue and a mystery to me. And I remember actually seeing a documentary about Walt Disney and how the whole thing started, with this little drawing of a mouse. And I used to doodle characters in my books at school and stuff. And I used to secretly dream that one day my characters would be known on the screen. In fact, I remember the first time I met Pete was at a film festival. And Pete has actually created this character called Morph, who's very big in Britain. He's like the British equivalent of Gumby. And he metamorphosizes into different things. And when I first met Pete, he had a badge on his lapel with Morph on it. And I just thought, how cool is that, having a badge that you can buy in the shops of your own character? I thought, wow.
But yeah, it's like something in your mind becoming a reality, this totally imaginary thing becoming yeah. a reality for so many people. At the end of Wallace and Gromit films, at least at the end of a couple of them, Wallace always yearns for some cheese. Mm-hmm. So why don't we end our interview with finding out about cheese? Why, why does Wallace cheese. Want cheese?
Well, yeah, how do ideas come about? I think the single reason there's cheese, because it all starts when Wallace and Gromit go to the moon to find cheese, and I was trying to think of a reason why they would go to the moon. And then, you know, we record the voices first, and I recorded with Peter Salis, the actor who plays Wallace. It's just the way he said, "Cheese, Gromit," and that made such a nice mouth shape for Wallace. It was such a nice thing to have him get his chops around that cheese stuck, and it appeared in all the other movies. In fact, there's a very short little story that there's a factory in the north of England that makes a type of cheese called Wensleydale cheese, and we made Wallace say Wensleydale one in the third film in a close shave, and just by doing that, it actually put the cheese factory was on its last legs and about to go into liquidation, and it put the cheese factory back in business.
You're kidding?
And
that's
yeah,
funny.
The Wensleydale Cheese Factory.
Well, I want to thank you both so much.
Thank you. Great pleasure.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you.
Nick Park and Peter Lord co-directed the animated film Chicken Run, which has just been released on video and DVD. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, from Watson Wyatt Worldwide, providing consulting services in employee benefits, human capital management, and HR technologies, on the web at watsonwyatt.com, and from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of the novel The Man Who Ate the 747 by Ben Sherwood. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, comic Jeffrey Ross and comic Freddie Roman, Dean of the New York Friars. They're featured in a documentary about the Friars Club, which has just been released on video. Also, reviews of the new TV series, Queer as Folk, and the new movie, Yee Yee. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This Sunday night, the Showtime cable network presents its Americanized remake of a controversial British series that attracted attention and then acclaim when it was shown on England's Channel 4 last year. The show is called Queer as Folk, and the controversy there stemmed from its unflinching look at the sex and drugs lifestyle of its characters, most of whom were gay men. TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new American version.
A lot of people are describing Queer as Folk in shorthand as a gay male version of Sex and the City. And on the surface, that's a fair way to sum it up. Sex and the City is about four attractive women who either have sex or talk about it constantly and are obsessed with men. Queer as Folk is about four attractive men who either have sex or talk about it constantly and are obsessed with men. The four friends in Queer as Folk are Brian, the ad agency executive whose looks and attitude can get him just about anyone he wants; Emmett, who is flamboyant enough to substitute for Will's best friend on Will and Grace; Ted, who is on the older side of 30 and acutely aware of it; and Michael, an all-around nice guy just looking for someone to love. In Sex and the City terms, Michael would be Carrie, and all the other guys, the sexual animal, the eldest buddy, the flamboyant friend, would be various shades of Miranda. But the Sex and the City parallels stop, and the real drama begins with the addition of a fifth major character in Queer as Folk. That character is Justin, a newcomer to the gay scene, who loses his virginity to the always-on-the-prowl Brian in the show's first episode. In the British version of Queer as Folk, the character was a shockingly young 15 years old. In this Showtime remake, he's a little older, but still young enough to make the series a lightning rod for controversy. Here's a scene from early in Sunday's two-hour premiere, set the morning after Brian and Justin have slept together. Randy Harrison plays Justin, and Gail Harold portrays Brian, who starts asking questions of his young guest that he neglected to ask the night before.
How old are you?
21.
What year were you born?
1979.
Bullshit. You had to think before you answered that. How old are you really?
20. 19. 18.
Well, what is this, a missile launch?
17.
Queer as Folk features steamy sex scenes that are the same sex equivalent of ones found in mainstream R-rated movies. Even in a TV season that has seen Will and Grace win several Emmys, and Richard Hatch running around naked on Survivor, and John Goodman embodying a gay character in his new primetime sitcom, Queer as Folk stands out. The upfront nature of the clinches and the kisses and the conversation makes it noteworthy. It's taken as a natural part of these people's lives and presented as such. Unfortunately, for about an hour into the TV show, that's all there is. Writers Ron Cohen and Daniel Lipman and director Russell Mulcahy seem to be counting on their high-energy sex scenes to carry the day. At first, the dialogue in Showtime's Queer as Folk sounds much too artificial and sitcom-y, and the dramatic scenes don't work at all. Perhaps the low point comes when Brian, during his turn at an ad exec business meeting, is supposed to be wowing the other people in the room with his power, charisma, and ideas. He's supposed to come off like Miles Drentel, that all-powerful advertising god from Once and Again and 30-something. Instead, he comes off more like Darren Stevens from Bewitched. But once Queer as Folk settles into its second hour, it also settles down. The jokes don't come as often, neither do the characters. And as we get to know them better, we get to care about them more. And that, along with the cliffhanger ending, makes it just enough to be worth a return visit.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. He'll guest host Fresh Air on Monday.
Thank you.
Coming up, two comics who are featured in a documentary about the Friars Club and its testimonial roasts. This is Fresh Air. The Friars Club is a private club for people in show business. Among its more celebrated former members are Irving Berlin, George M. Cohan, Will Rogers, George Burns, Groucho Marx, and Frank Sinatra. The Friars Club is famous for its testimonial roasts. A documentary about the club called Let Me In, I Hear Laughter has just been released on video. Last year, when the film was broadcast on Cinemax, I spoke with two of the comics featured in it. Freddie Roman is the dean of the New York Friars. For much of his career, he played the clubs in the Borscht Belt, the resort hotels of the Catskill Mountains in New York. He was one of the stars of the Broadway show Catskills on Broadway. Jeffrey Ross is one of the younger members of the Friars Club. He's become famous within the club for his hilarious insults at the testimonial roasts. He's performed in clubs around the country, on The Letterman Show and on Comedy Central. Let's talk about the roast, which is one of the things the Friars Club is most famous for. Freddie Roman, you've actually been roasted.
I sure was.
Jeff, were you at Freddie Roman's roast?
You know, I unfortunately think I was shooting a part in something, but
I was so disappointed he wasn't there, but...
It's the only one I missed in a long time, but I heard all the jokes.
We had a wonderful, wonderful roast. The roast master or roast mistress at my roast was Joy Behar, who currently stars on The View with Barbara Walters every morning. And she was absolutely brilliant doing it. She did a great job.
I wrote some good jokes about you that I didn't get to do, Freddie.
Yeah, do them now.
I was going to say, Freddie Roman's been doing comedy so long, his punchlines are in Latin. This is a guy who did the Ed Sullivan Show pilot.
I wish I was there. Yeah, you.
So Freddie Roman, what does it feel like to be sitting on the dais, everybody staring at you, as all of your showbiz friends are, you know, saying very funny, kind of insulting things about you?
You know, having been on the other side of it, I had done approximately 20 roasts myself, and having been on that side of it, and then to sit there, you sort of know what to expect, but yet when it hits you... And you sit there laughing because it is funny, and yet you're saying to yourself, geez, I hope he didn't mean that.
Right.
But no, in all, it was a great evening for me. It was a love fest. They did roast me, but they roasted me with a great feeling, and it was fun. I loved every second of it.
Jeff Ross, what are some of the roasts you've participated in?
I have done, my first one was Steven Seagal. With Milton Berle as the roast master.
Oh, wow, what a combo.
And let me just interject before Jeff goes on, only with this one story.
Uh-huh.
Milton Berle, who really was the king of the roast for 100 years, he's the best roast master there ever was. But he also had little habits, like he didn't like anyone else to be funnier than him. And so when Jeffrey got up, Milton interrupted him in the middle, which usually for a young comedian who's nervous enough about doing his own things could destroy the young comedian and get him flustered and all loused up. Well, Jeff Ross handled it like he had been doing it for 30 years. He put Milton in his place so beautifully that Milton just sat down and shut up, and that's the first time I ever saw Burl end up that way.
That's in the documentary. That whole is...
Is it?
Buddy Hackett and I tell that story intercut.
Mm-hmm.
Milton kept poking me in the ribs, which only I knew, you know, nobody can see that.
We couldn't see it.
No, but it's driving me nuts. You know, this guy is poking me in the ribs from right next to me. And finally, I just laid into him. I said, something about how old. I said, Milton, you know, Milton's Burl's been doing comedy so long, he lost to Mark Twain on Star Search.
Then you said something about him. With an antique shop or something.
Oh, yeah, you're right. I forgot about that. I said, Uncle Milton, we've actually met before. I saw you once downtown at an antique shop. $800.
which got one of the big screams of the entire afternoon.
So Buddy Hackett stood up off mic in that voice, and he said, "Hey, Milton, let the kid work. Remember when you used to?" And then, the place just exploded, and it's great. Buddy tells the story in the documentary in just such a funny way. When I was improvising with Buddy Hackett and Milton Berle in front of 1,300 people, I mean, I knew I was suddenly in the World Series of Comedy there, and holding my own. It was great.
And you won the MVP award that day, too.
Rookie of the Year. I roasted Danny Aiello. I've roasted Kelsey Grammer. I've roasted Mickey Rooney, Hugh Hefner, Jerry Springer, Drew Carey, and probably a couple others. Danny Aiello was great because he always comes to the roast. And he sat next to me at the Jerry Stiller roast. And it really helps me. You know, he's a great laugher. He cries. He wipes his eyes. He slams the table. And I told him that it just wouldn't be the same doing a roast unless he was there. He's just great. He cried at the end of his roast.
Was he?
He was overcome with the emotion of it, that we saw fit to put him down as a roastie in the same breath with some of the greatest stars in all of show business.
You know what? I was thinking about this lately. These are great comedians who are sitting down in their houses writing jokes about you. You can get Milton Berle or, like Jason Alexander to write about Jerry Stiller, to sit and think about this, to work and use their comedic minds to roast somebody. That's a great honor. And I think Danny, his background, you know, he was a doorman at the Improv when he was a young man starting out in show business. Danny Aiello understands how the art of comedy. And I think he was really moved by the effort that people made.
So what are some of the things you had to say about Danny Aiello?
What can you really say about Danny Aiello that hasn't already been said by some guy in the witness protection program with nine fingers? I made like somebody pass me a note halfway through the roast, and I said, "All kidding aside, Danny Aiello is my favorite actor or else."
Now, Freddie Roman, you've spent years working the hotels and country clubs in the Catskill Mountains, and then you appeared on Broadway in Catskills on Broadway. And
that was my baby, my crowning achievement, right?
So what are some of the ways you saw the Catskills change in the years that you performed there?
Well, when I started up there, there were over 200 places to work in. And so the smaller places took chances on new comedians because they didn't have budgets to book the big names. And it was a wonderful place to work out your craft because I would do 6, 7, 8 shows a week. And yes, I was getting $25 or $30 a show, but still it was $200 a week in those days. I could pay my rent, support my two children. And then every year it got a little bigger and a little better, and eventually I was making a wonderful living up there. And then what happened is the advent of the jet plane. Suddenly people could be in Florida in 2 hours, Puerto Rico in 3 hours, Las Vegas in 4 hours, and people started to go other places other than the heavily predominant Jewish crowd that used to come to the Catskills because it was an hour and a half away from New York by car. They suddenly found out they could fly to the Caribbean. They could fly anywhere they want. And the hotels started to suffer a little bit in that respect. So the amount of hotels declined quite quickly and until there was only the 7 or 8 big ones left. And that's what really happened. That was the rise and fall of the Catskills.
Jeff Ross, did you ever either play the Catskills or vacation in the Catskills?
Both.
Did you?
Yeah, sure. My parents took me up to Gross Singers when I was a kid. I remember seeing a comedian. I don't know who it was. Freddie, maybe you can help me. I remember the one joke. The guy was wearing a tuxedo, and he did a song. He sang a parody of, like, the Helen Reddy song. He said, "I am woman, as you know, because I sit down when I go."
Malzie Lawrence.
That was Malzie?
That was in Mal's act, yeah. Malzie Lawrence was one of my co-stars in Catskills on Broadway.
Right. Yeah.
For years, I thought that's what a comedian was. It was a guy in a tuxedo in the Catskills.
For years, that's what it was. That was it, yeah. You had to wear a tuxedo.
And I've since done them. You know, I kind of did my research. It's like paying your dues. I played a lot of the hotels. I remember opening for Jon Stewart on Singles Weekend. At the Concord. And, yeah. You know, 30 people walked out on me, and they told me I was a big hit. That's a tough crowd.
One of the great things about...
And then Jon Stewart didn't bring a sport jacket. We didn't know. And he felt so self-conscious. When I walked off stage, the band was playing him on. I took my jacket off, and he put it on and walked out with the same jacket.
Oh, that's funny. One of the great things about the Concord Hotel, which was the largest resort in the Catskills, Their nightclub sat 3,500 people. And one of the great things was those people, if they didn't care for you, they walked out. They just didn't sit there. So there were 8 doors leaving the Concord nightclub. And the next day you would always ask the maitre d', how was the show? And he'd say, 6 doors. 6 doors meant 3/4 of the audience left. But then every once in a while he would say, nobody left. And those were the tribute nights. My first time ever there on a Saturday night, I was opening for Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet. And I did a stroke of genius because they wanted to start the show while only half the people were in the nightclub. And if you're the opening act, it's murder with hundreds of people walking in. Nobody can pay attention to you. So I ripped the button off my tuxedo, and I had them get somebody from wardrobe to come and have to sew it on. And I killed an additional 12 minutes. So everybody was seated when I went on. And I killed the audience, and it made me a huge hit up there for the rest of my life. So that little trick actually worked for me.
Hmm.
I know Henny Youngman was a longtime member of the Friars Club and hung out there a lot. What did the Friars Club do when he passed not that long ago?
Well, we naturally, all of us were at the funeral. It was a huge turnout for his funeral. And we then did a memorial service for him at the club where his family was there, and all the comics got up and told anecdotes about Henny. And he was one of the great. I mean, he sat at the front table to the dining room. He died at 91 or 92. And every day people would walk by, Henny, how are you? And if someone had guests that weren't members of the Friars, it didn't matter. He would tell them, anyone had stopped at his table, he would tell them 3 jokes. Mm. He had little gimmicks he had that he would give them. He was an adorable man. Now, he did about 25 of our roasts and is in the history books as the only comedian in show business at a roast that never said one word about the guest of honor. They would introduce him, Henny Youngman, king of the one-liners, because he can't remember 2. Here he is, Henny Youngman. And Henny Youngman would come out and he'd look at the guest of honor and he'd say, so I went to the doctor and I said, doctor, I can't hold my water. What should I do? And the doctor said, get off my carpet. And he would do one joke after another. And finally, after 20 rapid-fire jokes about doctors, psychiatrists, he would turn to Milton Berle and say, I could talk about Milton Berle all day. Well, he never said a word about it. And he would sit down, and the people loved it, and they knew that's what he was going to do.
It occurred to me that Henny is in his 90s now. He walks into the club and gets the respect as if he opened at the Copa the night before. People clap when they see him. And I said, this is really what being a Friar must mean. I mean, you know, I'm a young guy. I'm in my 30s now. And, you know, comedy clubs come and go and club owners come and go. And we travel and I live by myself. It can be a very lonely job. And Henny must have lived through all the things that I'm living through 100 times. And that's, he goes there, and it's like Cheers. Everybody knows his name. He walks into place, and he's embraced. He's still a star in his 90s. And
George Burns, who was active until he was 98. It was only the last year and a half before he hit 100 that they didn't really work. But George Burns would come to the club, and 40 people would be around the table just listening to his anecdotes about vaudeville. I'll never forget, George Burns was 94, and they booked him at the Concord Hotel. And 3,500 people gave him a standing ovation. And the next day I was there, and I had lunch with him. And we were sitting at the lunch table, and an elderly man, about 80, walked over to him in a tennis outfit. And he said, George, I'm 80, George, and I play 2 sets of tennis every day. And Burns looked up at him and said, when I was 80, I had the clap. I mean, and those are wonderful, treasured memories that you hang around the club that you hear all the time. I mean, to this day, Alan King comes to the bar at 5 o'clock and holds court and does these wonderful show business stories about his wonderful career. And so it's still a great place. Young comedian, old comedian, middle-aged comedian. It's fun to be there.
Comics Freddie Roman and Jeffrey Ross recorded last year. They're featured in the documentary Let Me In, I Hear Laughter, A Salute to the Friars Club. It's just been released on video. Coming up, Henry Sheehan reviews the Taiwanese film Yi Yi, which was an award winner at the Cannes Film Festival. This is Fresh Air. The Asian films, which caused such a stir at Cannes and other international film festivals this year, are just now beginning to make their way into U.S. theaters. Yi Yi is a Taiwanese film whose director, Edward Yang, won an award at Cannes. The film's idiomatic title can be translated to the bandleader's count off a one and a two, or here we go. Film critic Henry Sheehan has a review.
You can understand why the Taiwanese movie Yi Yi evokes such positive response at the Cannes and Toronto film festivals. For one thing, the movie is unmistakably an Asian production. Loose medium shots, which emphasize connections between people and their situations, take the place of more Western-oriented close-ups, and visual discretion is preferred to flamboyance. But the movie's jam-packed narrative moves at a sprightly pace. On a superficial level, at least, the movie's plot is the stuff of an excellent beach read, with character after character landing in a series of unforeseeable conflicts, some comic, some sad, some romantic. The Jian family of Taipei lives at the nexus of competing cultures. The kids decorate their bedroom walls with posters of Western sports stars. Mr. Jian, or NJ as he's known, is a director of a small high-tech company that's been riding the Taiwanese economic tiger. And his wife, Min Min, is an efficient office manager. But director Edward Yang isn't interested in just depicting the destruction of an Eastern culture by a Western one. Now 53 years old, Yang is the son of Kuomintang parents who fled the Chinese mainland with Chiang Kai-shek's defeated forces. Growing up in an exile culture that insisted on the authenticity of its Chinese-ness, Yang grew increasingly aware of a native Taiwanese population, another authentic culture that was displaced by his own. But Yang isn't a cultural anthropologist. These issues interest him only insofar as they affect his characters. So, for example, when Min Min, the efficient office manager, suffers a breakdown over her own mother's illness, she doesn't go in for modern therapy. She goes off to a monastery in the countryside for meditation. But Yang doesn't leave things so simply. He shows us enough of the monastery's leader to let us know the man isn't running a purely traditional operation, but a new-agey facsimile. Min Min's problems are almost a sideshow to the main conflict since she disappears from the action. We spend time with each of the children, teenage Ting Ting and 8-year-old Yang Yang, as they work through problems. But the central conflicts involve NJ, the businessman. He and his partners are floundering as they look for an idea to jumpstart their company. While the others want a quick buck solution, NJ wants to enter into a risky but more honorable partnership with a maverick Japanese computer game designer. Yet both NJ and the Japanese designer, Ota, know their potential partnership is fraught with a risk greater than money.
I have no magic to save your company. Nobody. I am just like you. I have no tricks. We can work together. But I think your partner wants a magician.
I decide. I think they will.
Don't tell me now. Please.
Why?
Because you are a good man.
Nor is business NJ's only problem. he has run into the first love of his life, a woman named Sherry. NJ broke off their romance with abrupt cruelty, and now they seek not so much to resume it, though that always lurks as a possibility, but to examine and repair the ensuing emotional damage. There is, in other words, a whole lot of stuff going on here, so much that merely listing it sounds daunting. But Yi Yi isn't a classroom seminar on the travails of the Taiwanese middle class. It's a real movie, densely packed with comedy, romance, and if not tragedy, then grief. NJ's family constitutes only the core of the central characters. There are another three or four who figure in the movie almost as much as they do. The action has a freewheeling giddiness. You don't know who's going to be waiting around the next corner, ready to drop a load of laughs or tears onto you. Not that Yang is just wandering around those corners. He's on the prowl for something. Oda and NJ's talk about ethics, NJ and Sherry's attempts to understand their past, any number of encounters in the movie are all about stripping away the transitory and superficial and getting to an emotional, intellectual, and spiritual essence. Yang doesn't automatically trash pop culture or valorize traditional mores, but he'll rely on either one if it helps his characters reach that old goal, truth.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. The band's co-leader and soprano saxophonist, Philip Johnston, has just become a father. We congratulate Philip and his wife, Hilary Bell, on the birth of their son, Moss. We'll close with music from Philip Johnston's CD, The Needless Kiss. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Wizard of Oz, the Frank L. Baum book that was adapted into the popular movie, is 100 years old. On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Michael Patrick Hearn, author of The Annotated Wizard of Oz. Join us for the next Fresh Air.